Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host. I train product managers to be product masters. A lot of people get into product management who never really learn what they need to know, and I'm changing that through this podcast and through my online training. Head over to where the show notes are for this episode at theeverydayinnovator.com/087, and you'll also see what it means to be a product master. I enjoyed a wonderful conversation with Saeed Khan. He started the On Product Management blog and has been a career product manager working in Toronto, Canada, as well as Silicon Valley. He is also a frequent speaker at product management events, including product camps, something I personally love going to when I have the opportunity. I saw a presentation of his that he did on the topic of successfully using product management metrics. I wanted to explore this topic with him, along with what else it takes to be a good product manager, which is what we did in this discussion. So once again, the show notes for our discussion, along with the summary and transcript, can be found at theeverydayinnovator.com/087. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Hi, Saeed. Thanks so much for joining the Everyday Innovators and talking about metrics with us.
Thanks, Chad. I'm glad to be here.
It's going to be a great discussion. Metrics is an important topic that we've explored a little bit on the podcast, but haven't dove into it in a great way, and looking forward to doing that with you. Why don't we just get started with, what is this thing called a metric? I'm not sure, we're not talking about the English versus metric system here, like kilometers.
Sure.
Let's get grounded what a metric is.
So the way I look at metrics is that a metric, particularly in business, is sort of any type of measurement that you can make that can gauge some kind of quantifiable component of performance, right? So it could be like a sales metric, could be numbers, or a marketing metric could be leads, but it's really very domain specific. And for product management, there should be specific metrics as well.
Yeah. Something that's quantified, a number of something of importance that we're going to track.
Exactly.
Okay. And so when it comes to product management, why is it that product managers should be thinking about metrics? Why in product management do we need metrics?
So there's two words in product management. There's product and there's management. And there's that old adage, you can't manage what you can't measure. So when we think about management, what are we really thinking about? Is it just an ad hoc sort of set of tasks we do and, things work out well or not? Or can we apply some discipline to it and some kind of real sort of business focus and make sure that what we're doing to make things successful really is working?
Okay. So for the business focus, and if you see me looking down some of the time, I'm taking some notes here as we go.
Sure.
Help me keep track of things, and want to make sure I record all the good stuff here. From the business perspective, sometimes we hear this product managers talk in terms of being the mini CEO of a product. When I first heard that, it personally made me feel good, right? I'm a 20-something, like, wow, I'm in charge of the product. I must be important in this organization. And then later find out that you're not really in charge of anything as a product manager often. You're more of a coordinator, some product managers have P&L responsibility, but others don't for sure. So I'm not sure how far this analogy actually works. But when you talk about this in a business sense, this would seem to apply, right? That being the CEO of the product, maybe thinking of it more in a business sense.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, that line, I think, is the product manager truly the CEO of the product? No, they're not. I mean, in some companies, it might be that case, but in most companies, it's not the case. But regardless of that, there's nothing stopping you from acting like the CEO of your product and thinking like the CEO of your product. And if you think and act like it, whether you have that responsibility or not, then you know what? You might actually get that responsibility. Mm-hmm. But secondly, you can lead others much more effectively because they'll view you as acting like the leader. So I think there's that sort of mindset that, I can't do it because I wasn't given the authority. Well,
right.
Seize the authority.
Right.
And then see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point that reminds me of Steve Jobs' quote, which I'll paraphrase because I don't remember word for word. But basically, at one time he said something like, everything that we all know how organizations work and what is what was made up by people no smarter than you, right?
And yes, that's right.
And I like what you said about, you know, even if you're not in that position of really being truly responsible, like a CEO would be, of the product, you can still act like it, because doing so makes you a better leader and will lead to better things in your career. And you'll just have more influence in the organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, and we probably actually have more freedom to do that than we think so, at least according to Steve Jobs' quote. So,
well, I think there's a lot more freedom, regardless of Steve Jobs. I think there's a lot more freedom in companies. I mean, when senior management says things like that, even if they don't act like they believe it, that's an opportunity for you to seize that opportunity, right? And if you don't seize it, someone else will, quite honestly. I mean, you know, like if you don't act like a leader, guess what? The VP of engineering will act like the leader and, you know, take that from you. So I just think it's something that we all should think about. And if we don't do it, it's our loss.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this year there's really been a resurgence in the popularity of product management. You know, there's these articles in the Wall Street Journal and other places about, you know, product management is the new title that graduate MBAs want to have. It's the new hot role.
Yeah.
And part of that, it is just kind of a cool role. You get to have a lot of influence and be responsible for strategy and tactics at the same time. But this is one of the unique roles inside organizations where you get to have such a cross-functional view of how things actually work or don't work. And you get to build a lot of influence along the way. And indeed, it can lead to executive positions inside companies because you get a very unique perspective of the company.
Absolutely. My first product management job, which was, you know, 20 years ago, it was eye-opening for me because, in fact, that company, it was a small company here in Toronto, but the president truly did put us in that role. I mean, he obviously had, you know, final say in things, but we had budget responsibility, we had revenue responsibility, we had, you know, obviously product responsibility. We were doing a lot. And I in a way, I was spoiled because even though that was my first product management job and it was difficult, I had the most authority that I can remember in any product management role I've had since. And so I think that when it happens, it's eye-opening because I got to get a really good operational view of the company, albeit a small company, but I understood how the pieces fit together. I understood what was dependent on what. And that experience has actually helped me over the last 20 years in all my other jobs.
What a great holistic perspective of the organization, right? To really see it as a system instead of just functions that we do.
Exactly.
So for metrics, I tend to think of product management as this big spectrum. And some of the everyday innovators listening know I have used this framework in the past called the IDEA framework. Because you know, anything that can help me remember is an important aid for me. So IDEA stands for ideate, develop, evolve, and accelerate. And kind of the first three parts of that are what people often think of as product management. You know, where ideas come from, that's the ideate or the fuzzy front end part. Develop is kind of the middle, new product development process. And then evolve is what happens once we actually launch our product and get it in the marketplace. And I know we could dive into metrics in any one of those areas. Where would you like to start talking about metrics that make sense for product managers to be using?
Yeah, so that's interesting. And if we use your model, the IDEA sort of stages, right? I look at it a bit differently, but I have this mantra that I talk about the stages of the product lifecycle. Mm-hmm. And it goes build it, nail it, scale it, extend it, milk it, end it.
Yep.
And that, you know, I mean, roughly speaking, you have four, I have six, but those are really talking about the same things, which is, you know, how you define what you want to do, how you build it and then grow it, and then how you manage it over its life cycle. And the thing is that, you know, whether we use your acronym or my mantra, things are different at different stages, right? What you focus on is different. Mm-hmm. What's important is different, and how you need to react or adapt or work are different. So I think that's the interesting thing about product management and what makes it complex is that it's not a static thing. And as an example or a counterexample, you know, I'll use sales, right? Now, I'm not sort of belittling sales, but sales is very singularly focused. You've got, you know, your target number, you've got your funnel, you've got, you know, other things, you know, stages of deals, et cetera. And you know what? From month to month to month, quarter to quarter to quarter, those things are pretty much static. And so it's easy to define what's important. Mm-hmm. In product management, you need to be a little more evolved and dissect it and then say, you know, in the early stages, revenue is not as important. But in the middle stages, revenue is important, et cetera, right? In the early stages, product focus is really important. At the end of life, product focus is not important. So you need to understand where your product is or what your goals are, so to speak, at each stage, and then define what's important. And those are the metrics that you track.
Okay. So when it comes to, like you said, revenue is not important in the early stages. It sounds like in that instance, in the early stage, are you talking about in your framework, you have to go through it again for me. We've introduced the product to the marketplace and are we scaling it?
Yeah. So I bet you if you repeat it after me three times, you'll never forget it. We won't go through that now. But yeah, so build it is the very first stage.
Sure. Right?
So you're building. And you're not building in a vacuum. You know, you're building in the context of some market needs or customer needs or something like that. And so what's important there, and you're not just building it in isolation, so you're working with other people, right?
Right. And while you're talking about building it, sorry for interrupting there, just I want to throw out something for you and see if it fits or not. So maybe a metric for build it, when I'm thinking of building it and understanding the customer's needs, one thing we might keep track of is, you know, maybe the number of customer interviews that we've done with how many people, or maybe even the number of needs that we've captured, you know, that we're addressing or keeping track of.
Yeah, it could be. And it could also be things like you know, just product quality, right? In the early stages, I mean, you care about product quality at a time, but in the early stages, you definitely want to think about product quality. The other thing I didn't mention is when I think of these metrics, I look at them in four broad categories, right?
Okay.
And this for me is kind of a holistic thing. So the first one I think about personally, because it's sort of where I'm most sort of focused, or I want to be most focused, is business. There's a bunch of things in your business strategy and business objectives you need to understand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that could be pricing, it could be overall strategy, it could be other things that are more business focused. The next one is your go-to-market. So even at the early stages, you really need to think about go-to-market. And go-to-market is not just marketing, you know, so to speak. It's how you're going to go to market, what you're going to go to market with, who you're going to go to market to, et cetera. There's organizational readiness, which is, you know, internal focus, but you can measure how well across your company people are ready to, you know, do what needs to be done for the product. And then lastly, and certainly not least, is product.
All right.
So those are the four stages. And then in each of those, you could break them down into, you know, sort of metrics. And, you know, I use the term metrics, and some people take it very literally, like it's some number you can measure on a scale. But I look at it more in terms of, you know, it could be even some qualitative thing. So, you know, from a sales perspective or a business perspective, you can look at things like revenue or pipeline or, you know, win-loss analysis, right? How are you doing there? You could look at deal size, you could look at pricing, et cetera. You could look at channel numbers. You know, for go-to-market, it could be things like how good is your positioning? Is it ready? You know, how are you looking against competition? Do you have some way to evaluate that? You know, what's going on with things like references, if that's what you're interested in? So there are things in the go-to-market and launch readiness that are there. Anything related to organizational readiness could simply be metrics within the company of, you know, is support ready, is sales ready, are you know, other groups that need to be sort of integral in the process, where are they in terms of readiness?
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, for product, it's everything from strategy to roadmap to product quality to whatever. So, you know, these are all things you can measure, some a little more sort of numerically than others. But fundamentally, if you focus on those things and you track them, you can have a very clear picture of where you're weak, where you're strong, and where you need to focus.
Okay. So let's dive into some of those specifics then, like organization readiness.
Yeah.
To measure that, you know, some of these things, like you said, some are quantitative measures. In other places, I was thinking maybe a checklist is a helpful tool to say, you know, do we have the elements we expect? You know, is the collateral ready? Is customer support in place? Have we trained the salespeople?
Yeah, and those activities definitely are qualitative things, but they happen, you know, there's a timeline for them and there's an assessment for them. So I tend to look at these things or try and look at them in terms of very simple things like maybe a red, yellow, green kind of status. Hmm. Like, are we on track and on schedule? Are we behind schedule? Are we running into issues? You know, like sales training, sometimes you can't do the sales training, you know, completely. If you're a worldwide company, you know, some of the sales training won't get done by the time the product launches.
Right.
And, you know, you're going to have a clear picture of that and say, okay, you know, we're going to really focus on North America for the initial launch. And then we'll, you know, next we'll go to EMEA and finally we'll go to APAC. And APAC won't happen for 3 months after launch, but then that's okay because, you know, we won't be doing our marketing in APAC anyway, so until we're ready. So those are the sorts of things you can look at. And then even simple sort of measurements like that can help people understand what's going on. And a lot of times people make assumptions, but until they see it, you know, in a sort of very clear way, they won't realize that, oh, yeah, you know what? APAC isn't ready because we don't expect APAC to be ready.
Okay.
Whereas North America absolutely has to be ready, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want to make it fit the your launch strategy and how you're rolling this out also.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I worked in a company once, and this is, I won't mention the company, but, you know, what was nice about it was in the kitchen, they would put up a big poster of the launch and they'd have a countdown to days until the release. And, you know, everyone went to the kitchen. Like it was, you know, you go get your coffee or your juice or whatever. So there was no excuse for anyone not to know when the next release was. And so we were, once the release date came, we were waiting for like all the standard launch activities and press releases and everything. Mm-hmm. And there was silence and we're like, what's going on? What's going on? And then it was not a small company, but it wasn't a huge company either. But then, you know, marketing said they weren't aware of the release date. And I have no idea how that happened, but you know what? Like something was deeply wrong there. And, right. And I was just thankful I wasn't in the marketing side, but those things happen. I don't know how they happen, and I think that when you make things simple and clear and visible, you hopefully minimize if not eliminate, you know, the causes of problems like that.
Yeah, and that does speak to the challenges with different sizes of organization. You said this wasn't a real big organization, but it wasn't small either.
Yeah.
That, you know, at different scales, we typically have different processes put in place to help keep everyone on the same page.
Yes.
And, you know, if we were talking to a Microsoft, it might take them a year, literally, to get a rather insignificant update done to a product.
Yeah.
Just because of all the coordination that goes on.
Yes.
And they have all the coordination going on to make sure things don't drop through the cracks. But a startup with three founders that are moving at a much different pace, you know, quickly making changes that as they're trying to nail it with a product direction and what's actually satisfying customers. And they would need different metrics in place, I think.
So absolutely. I mean, it's critical. The way I look at it is, you know, there's no single set of metrics that works for everyone. And you need to track what's important to you. In what aligns with your goals and what's important. And so I think in the three founder startup, when they're trying to nail it. And so nail it is really the stage where after you've built it, you know, you've got something, you're out there, you're getting feedback, et cetera. Nail it means you've got it really, really well done for a given use case or a given mm-hmm. customer segment, right? You know, some software is really targeted. Some of it is not, but you know, it really works. And you know it really works because you're getting, you know, a certain amount of customer feedback and the vast majority of it is very positive. You know, if you're measuring things like net promoter score, maybe that's another way of doing it. Whatever your metrics are that are important, you get it right. And then uh-huh. and then scale it means you're scaling your business as well as your product. So, you know, you might be looking at, you know, really focusing on customer growth. And obviously revenue growth at that point. But if you do that, your business has to be ready for it. So I've seen companies uh-huh. where they scaled it before they nailed it, meaning that their product really wasn't ready to go to market, but they went to market, they had some customer success, and then, you know, overjoyed by some customer success, they hired lots more salespeople and spent lots of money on marketing and all that stuff. And the real, you know, sad point is that all they did was scale their problems. Uh-huh. Right. And at significantly unnecessary cost. You know, you've got salespeople going out making sales calls for a product that really doesn't address market needs. Now, what's the net result of that? So I think if you really look at things honestly, you can make those assessments very clear and then make those decisions properly. So not to hire more salespeople or spend more on marketing. Sometimes these things happen for emotional or other reasons, but I think, you know, I try and take a very non-emotional view of things as much as possible.
Usually wise, so we don't get wrapped up in it ourselves, right? One thing happens, this has nothing to do with metrics, but as product managers and people involved in the process, we can think of this thing that we're making, you know, this new thing we're bringing into the world as our own baby in some sense, right? And people get connected to it as opposed to recognizing, you know, I'm a resource and I need to use my time and capabilities as best as possible. And if yes. my baby isn't developing properly, then I yeah. should probably go start working on a new one.
Yeah, you know, it's a fine line. So I'll admit that I have had emotional attachment to products, but there's a line where you use that attachment for beneficial purposes, mm-hmm. but you don't let that emotional attachment sort of cloud your judgment. So, you know, despite, let's say it's a product that you really love, but it's not really a great product. You can still love it, but you should also realize, hey, this is not a great product. Let's do the right thing for this not so great product, as opposed to saying, I love this product and I'm going to make it a success and I'm going to, you know, blindly move forward with it. So I think those two things have to be taken into account. And uh-huh. and I think passion is important. I would hate to be a dispassionate product manager because, you know, then I'm just punching the clock. But yep. again, you know, the decisions you make have to be the decisions that are best for product. One time I was working in a company and the president was not really giving one product that I managed the resource it needs. And I was in a management meeting and I said, look, if we're not going to do the right things, let's just sell this product off. And everybody just stared at me. And I was like, no, because either we do the right thing for it or we don't invest anything at all. We're wasting our money here. That got shot down, but then a year later they sold the product off. So, you know, maybe I was right. It just took a year for the others to realize it.
You were the prophet in the desert, and it took a while for people to actually listen, right?
Well, I don't know. I was emotionally attached to that product, but I wanted it to be treated properly, or someone else can treat it properly. Like one way or another, you have to do the right thing. So anyway, it was just one of those things where I just, you know, threw out the sort of extreme solution, mm-hmm. and that did, at least for a short period of time, push people into action. Right. But in the end, the right thing was that it was not where the company was focusing, and they made the right decision.
Yeah, and that's certainly a good criteria to look at when it comes to either retiring a product, removing it from the marketplace, or looking at a partner taking it on, or just selling it, you know, getting acquired, is when there just isn't excitement around it anymore. It's like, there's been some shifts in where we're going. This one doesn't really get people excited anymore. It obviously doesn't have our attention. We should probably think about it having a different home.
Absolutely.
So I like this framework you got going on here, the build it, nail it, scale it sort of thing. So let's talk about some specifics then. You know, build it is obviously where the product gets ready. Nail it is when we have our launch to customers, you know, so that commercialization of the product where they're starting to buy it, right?
Yeah.
What would be metrics that we should be looking at in the nail it stage? And you talked about these four business kind of categories, right? The actual business itself, the go-to-market, organization readiness, and the product itself.
Yeah.
Probably get wrapped up in this. Help us understand what we should be looking at when we're trying to nail it and what kinds of things we want to measure during that time of, you know, hopefully what is growth for our product.
Sure. So, you know, it's a bit of an evolving process. So in the beginning, you know, it's also really where you're focusing. So if we take those four categories, in the nail it side, your sort of major focus areas are obviously on the product to get it right. Mm-hmm. And then your go to market. How are we going to take this to market? And what needs to be, you know, the right messaging, right positioning, you know, who are we going to market it to, et cetera. And then not ignored at all, by the way, are the business and the organizational readiness, but they're not as critical at that point, right? You don't need every single department in the company focused on that product at that time. Yes, they have to have focus, but they're not, you know, unless it's a one product company, then of course that's what everyone does. But fundamentally, you have a higher focus on those two areas, go to market and product. When you think about that, you can look at, okay, obviously all the various product metrics you need, whether it's, you know, specific technical product metrics or, you know, sort of product market fit type of things that you want to look at, mm-hmm. right? How are we doing in terms of, you know, evaluations or in terms of competitive scenarios or in terms of sales, you know, are we really hitting the mark when it comes to our, you know, if you do POCs or evaluations or whatever, those are all things you want to really focus on. And then once you get to scale it, so scale it, as I mentioned, is you're not just scaling the product, you're scaling the business, right? You want it to grow customers, you want to grow revenue, you might be even, you know, expanding geographical coverage or something like that. You're really scaling up. So now everything comes into play. Like, you really have to have your business strategy and your business objectives crisp. You definitely need your company aligned organizationally. Everybody needs to be really moving forward together. And then the other two still remain as, you know, very prime, you know, you go to market and your product. So the kinds of metrics I mentioned earlier, so things like, and again, these are not, you might be able to turn them into numerical metrics. So the easiest ones are obviously like the sales and marketing metrics, right? You know, your funnel, your conversion rate or your pipeline or whatever. You may not be at a level to measure renewals or anything like that yet. You know, whether you've got geographic contribution, you might be looking at that and saying, hey, how are we doing in geographies, you know, or where do we need to expand to? So those are all things you can look at. Those are more pure sort of sales and business metrics. But in terms of like marketing, you know, you might get into some of the standard marketing metrics, you know, that you look at. Some of them might be things like references or, you know, funnels or social media or even, you know, what's the state of your collateral. And collateral tends to get overlooked because, you know, oh, we got a data sheet, we have a white paper, et cetera. But really that should be aligned with your sales process, right? You know, and so you've got different people at different stages of sales process, you know, suspect, prospect, you know, evaluator, buyer, et cetera. What you're doing in terms of information flow to them should be aligned there. So, and a lot of times, again, that's not really done sort of predetermined way. You know, collateral gets created. Okay, great. Anyone got a white paper on X, or do we have an ROI spreadsheet on Y, et cetera? You know, it seems to be done ad hoc in a lot of companies. But if you align all that and then you measure how are we doing, where are we things dropping off, then you can actually get some clear metrics. And then people like product managers should really be overseeing that. A lot of times, you know, people hand that off to marketing or product marketing and they don't pay attention. You know, they're saying, hey, I'm busy driving the roadmap for the next release. But really, if your release that's out there isn't really successful or as successful as it could be, why are you focusing on building the next one, right? Get the first one successful. So that's the, you know, you haven't really nailed that part of the product, right? Before you sort of want to scale your development efforts. So the metrics can be, you know, as simple or as complicated as you need to be. I tend to view things at a fairly high level. I look at numbers. I'm a numbers guy. But, you know, I don't think that you get a lot by being too numbers oriented. You know, some people might thrive on that. I tend to say, look, I have to look across the board. So I'm going to look at the things that are important across the board.
It's that bigger picture, maybe a more holistic perspective, right? Because numbers in one area might mislead us without understanding some of the dependencies and relationships between what's important.
Exactly. And the thing is that those metrics are not 100% indicators of one thing or another, but they, you know, when you look at them collectively, you might, you want to be able to connect the dots and see the patterns. And if you see that, hey, yeah, we're really executing on the marketing side, sales seems to be doing okay, but you know, we have this problem over here. You know, support seems to be overwhelmed, right? Well, guess what? Like, why support overwhelmed? Even though QA told you all the bugs were fixed, there's some problems going on. And so when you start looking at those kind of metrics, you can say, okay, let's dig down and find the real problem, right? So the metrics won't tell you necessarily what the problem is, but they should guide you to where to focus. And you know, support might, I have a call, a weekly call with customer support, or my customer support team. We've been doing it for years. Like I think it's, you know, standing meeting for the last 6 years. And it's great because they will tell me exactly when things are not going well. And certainly, you know, if you see that right after a launch, that's not a good sign.
Yeah. And that's when you want customer support involved, especially right after the launch.
Yeah. Well, I think they're, you know, they're often underappreciated.
Yeah.
And I think that they are amongst the closest people to the customer in many ways. And I tend to listen to them as much as I can.
Yeah, which for me is why it's such a frustrating trend that's been going on for some time now that we're outsourcing so much of customer support. And those people, you know, even if it's we've done a good job outsourcing and we've created a good team to do the work, they're not invested still in the feedback they're getting from customers. And it's you know, any customer contact should be a really valued experience that a company wants to make the best as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, I think they have to be invested in the product. Most customer support people I've worked with have been really great. So I do think that outsourcing something like that has a definite downside.
Yep. So let me give you an example as you're talking about the scale-up point. So I was thinking, you know, one thing that is going on when we're scaling it is we're trying to get our product out to more people. So that might take shape as having more distribution channels for it. You know, if this is a physical product, maybe we have actual distribution warehouses that we're going through, or it's a intangible product, service, or software or something. We still may have partners that are reselling this on our behalf, right? So we're increasing channels as we scale it. And we might be looking at metrics that tell us, you know, we have some distributors that aren't working as well as others, and we might, without diving in further, come to some wrong conclusions about that. It might tell us that there's some segments in our, you know, among our markets and target segments that are actually should be where we're spending more time, and the others that aren't really worth the attention that we're giving them right now.
Yes.
So, and keeping track of that sort of thing seems like that could be helpful. Metrics, like you said, we want the metrics to fit the problem that we have, fit what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, exactly. And it could be that, like, for example, with resellers, and I've dealt with resellers in the past, and some of them are better than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing we tend to forget about resellers is they're not just reselling our product.
Right.
They're actually reselling other people's products as well. And so we had a case once, this is a long time ago, where a reseller who'd been doing really well, suddenly their sort of, you know, sales of our product dropped off, and everyone's wondering why. And, you know, like the immediate thing was, oh, it's, we had a new release recently and it's a product issue and, you know, they weren't trained properly and blah, blah, blah. And the answer was no, it had nothing to do with it. It's just that one of their other, you know, partners whose products they were selling suddenly gave them some huge, you know, sort of incentives
right
to sell that product. And guess what? You know, A plus B plus C is a constant, right? So when product A focus went up, product C focus went down.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that, but nobody really thought to kind of look at, well, what are they doing with other companies? Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with us. So, and that happens internally as well. And I've seen it with products where you have salespeople who sell multiple products and, you know, magically one shiny new object gets all the attention and the sort of, you know, less shiny older object suddenly drops and people are wondering, why is that other object dropping? Why aren't they all going up together? And the answer is, well, because those salespeople, they're focusing on what's easiest to meet their quota. They're not looking at which product is going up and which product is going down.
And that's an important thing for product managers to be aware of. I'm glad you brought up the example of, you know, recognizing what might be going on at the distributors or resellers, because you're one of many, right? And
exactly.
If not quotas in place, their mind share is going to go where the best opportunity for them is. And it's the same for our internal salespeople and making sure that product managers are actually engaged with sales management and knowing what are the goals for different products and how does that fit in with, you know, what our objectives are is really important.
Yeah. And actually, this is interesting. So in one of my first product management jobs, I had this problem where I was, you know, not working on this shiny new object product. And sales, you know, they went up for a while, but then, you know, they started going down because the salespeople as a team started focusing on the newer products. And I was, among other things, compensated on, you know, the success of my product. So I felt it both, you know, in the sales reports, but also in my bonus check. And I went to the salespeople and I asked them, like, why aren't you selling this product? And they were very honest. They said, well, it's easier to sell the other product. That's where all the marketing is, da, 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 da.
Right.
And my first instinct was, okay, well, we have to set some kind of quotas on this product. Like, I can't have these salespeople just ignoring the product. And sales management was like, I can't do that. I can't tell them they have to sell 20% of your product and 60% of another product. I mean, they have to meet quota and I have to let them decide how they'll best meet quota. And in the end, what happened was a couple of sales reps said, you know what? I think I can sell a lot of this older product. And they actually stepped up and volunteered. They said, look, we want to be dedicated sales reps for that product. Mm-hmm. And the way they looked at it was there was a large customer base for that product. There was a good maintenance stream. They could sell back into those accounts. They didn't need a lot of marketing. And instead of, you know, 10 or 20 salespeople all sharing a piece of this small pie, a couple of them would split the larger pie, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. And guess what? Like the focus came back, sales went up, and everyone was happy, right? The guys who wanted to sell that product sold as much of it as they could. The people who didn't want to sell it could focus on the new shiny objects. But that was something that initially did not go over well with management when it was proposed. They were like, we can't do that. We've always had sales reps, you know, share product. We've never had dedicated sales reps. But once the salespeople stood up and said, we want that, you know, I guess it's the messenger, not the message. Right. They listen.
Right. They're pulling it instead of you trying to push it.
Yes, exactly.
And that's a good way to address that problem, right? If there's appeal for this product still and salespeople are recognizing, I think I can do well with that. And we could just focus on that.
Yeah.
It's a good example. So we talked about nail it some, scale it. Remind me what comes next?
Extend it.
So what are we looking at for metrics inside Extend It?
So Extend It is an interesting phase. And I think it's the most interesting of all of them personally, because when I say Extend It, what I mean is you move into new markets, new market segments, new use cases. You know, you're going to look at new customers as well. Or extending, you know, your reach inside of companies that already use the product. So, this is almost like the rebirth of the product, right? You've kind of taken one trajectory, you've gone up, you reach a certain point. Now you're saying we have to go further. Mm-hmm. How can we go further? And you have to go further using new approaches or new tactics. So, you know, extending a product could be new features, right? New capabilities, but it certainly could be, you know, marketing and sort of, you know, new positioning and new use cases, et cetera. So this one is interesting because, again, extended is, I mean, it's a very broad topic and it depends on the approaches you take. But you would look at, for example, if you're looking at new features, then you really want, and new use cases, then you really want to look at adoption of those new use cases with your market. So, you know, your salespeople have been selling it to do X. Now it can do X and Y. Are customers actually buying it for Y, right? So right. Use case Y or scenario Y or whatever. And if so, how is the adoption for that? Is it good? Is it not good? I mean, oftentimes a successful product will do really well, but then when it's extended, it's like brand extension. When you extend it to the second thing, people still think about it as doing only the first thing. And so the adoption of the second or third or additional use cases is actually quite small. You know, it's incremental as opposed to being, you know, significantly additive. So those are the kind of things you want to do. Or if you say, look, we're going to extend through geography, how are you going to reach these new geographies? And, you know, how are you doing in those geographies? So the nature of the extend drives the metrics that you would track.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. What you're trying to accomplish, if it's, can we get more of our existing customers maybe to buy an add-on or, you know, a related product, or can we extend our actual market size to a new geography or a new target segment?
Yeah.
Or it might I think another case would be, can we dive into a market segment and blow that up more?
Exactly. So one great example in the market that I'll talk about is VMware, right? So I don't know if you know the history of VMware, but you know what server virtualization is, I hope.
But yeah, and just for listeners, right? Because okay. We have people from building products to software okay. and toothpaste and everything in between. So
okay.
So VMware, one of the things they got really big known for was the capability to virtualize systems, servers often, onto one physical platform. So you take one physical server machine, like from Dell or HP, maybe run 10 logical servers on that thing.
Yes, right? Exactly. So when they first came to market, which is, you know, many, many years ago, first of all, the technology was new. People didn't understand it. People didn't see the value of it, mm-hmm. et cetera. But their initial target that they got a foothold in enterprises was in QA. And QA teams, you know, if you know about sort of enterprise QA, they need to have multiple different configurations of the servers so they can test all these different configurations of the company's software. Mm-hmm. You know, this is really expensive if you have to have dedicated hardware for every different configuration, which used to be the case. And then here comes VMware saying, hey, look, you can have multiple configurations on the same single hardware and you can switch them out as needed. And this use case was great. I mean, it was, you know, the audience was already a technical audience. Mm-hmm. There was not a lot of risk in terms of doing that. There was a clear cost savings, et cetera. And so that's where they got a foothold in enterprise. And they were doing that for many years. And it wasn't until later on that the idea of, you know, virtualizing servers in production, for example, and having dynamic server workloads and all these kinds of things that are, you know, commonplace now took hold. But when they moved from this sort of niche QA audience into the broader IT, enterprise IT audience, that's when their growth exploded. So, You know, they built it. They nailed right. that one use case.
Right.
They scaled it up. They were used widely in lots of different QA environments in different companies. But it was that next sort of phase, extend it, which is when they really saw huge success and became dominant in the market. So mm-hmm. that's why I say I really like that extend it phase, because it really is, you know, at the heart of what product manages. How can we take this technology and apply it to different markets? And then how do we make it successful? If they tried to go to that server virtualization market, you know, at the beginning, they would have failed miserably, because people right. said, there's no way I'm taking my production environments and putting them on your software. And, you know, who knows sure. what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's unproven, right?
Yes.
But they nailed it in one specific use case.
Yes.
Big use case, and grew it from there.
Yeah.
And part of that was just watching trends too. You know, another way they extended it later was in the disaster recovery space.
Yes.
Because it was easier to back up a VMware server than
Absolutely.
Other things, right?
So, absolutely. Yeah, no, there's lots of use cases that went from there. But that's the heart of that. And so what was important to them when they extended it into you know, the general IT environment? Well, it was certainly very different than what was important for QA people.
Right. Being aware of what those differences are is certainly important. And we might create some metrics around that to track it.
Yes.
So that takes us through extend it. So we got build it, nail it, scale it, extend it, and?
Milk it.
Milk it.
Yeah. So milk it, you know, people talk about some products being a cash cow, right? So it's sort of the same metaphor, but you know, you're reducing investment in the product. You've got a large customer base. If you're on a product that has maintenance renewals, you're probably having a significant portion of your revenue coming from maintenance renewals. Uh-huh. And then you're continuing to just, you know, do the things to sell into those markets, but it's not heavy investment. It's not intended for growth. It's really intended to maximize profits,
right?
So you're reducing your overall costs, you're increasing your margin, and you know, like I said, one of the first products I ever managed was in that phase. It was really a very mature product, and the profits from that product were actually funding some of the other investments in the company. So they really wanted to maximize things, and you know, as a first product to manage, that was, you know, not the most exciting thing. I tried to make it as exciting as I could. But it's a reality for every product. At some point, they go, you know, from into this phase where you're really looking to just get cash. And a lot of companies, you know, CA as an example, has a lot of products in that phase. Uh-huh. You know, these are very mature products that have maintenance streams, and they don't require a lot of R&D. And that's sort of the way they focus a lot of their business.
Right. And as a part of a healthy portfolio, we need some cash cows.
Yes.
You know, because they keep revenue coming in and help us fuel spending money on innovation and new product development.
Exactly. And so in those cases, you don't really care about a lot of the product metrics, right? You're not changing mm-hmm. the product much. Certainly, you want it to be stable if you update it, but you don't really look at it from a feature functionality perspective. Your go-to-market obviously isn't going to change at that point. You're not going to launch some radically new marketing programs, you know. And from business perspective, things are static, you know. So whatever you're tracking metrics before, whether it's funnel, sales, marketing funnel, et cetera, strategy, those are pretty static. And the real one is, you know, I think where focus is still needed is organizational readiness. So you have a huge customer base. They're going to be having to deal with, you know, the various aspects of your company, support for sure, mm-hmm. Probably services if that's the kind of company you have. And so you want to make sure that all of those groups are still aligned. And part of it also is that, you know, for a lot of people, that milk it phase is kind of boring, and it's no longer the shiny new object.
Right.
So, you know, it's just from a product management perspective, you want to keep those people aligned and enthusiastic about the product. Like say, hey, even though we're not investing a lot, this is really the product that's paying your paycheck. So you might want to make sure it does well.
Right,
because we're all bound by how well this product does and contributes to the bottom line.
Exactly.
So I think those are things that people need to understand and focus on. And the thing is that this milk it phase could be a very short period of time if there's you know, dynamic market changes, or it could be a very, very long time if the market and need is pretty static. You know, I've seen some products that a decade they're just in that phase, and a company is just pulling the profits out. I once worked for a company that was acquired by Novell, and I was shocked to see how much NetWare maintenance revenue Novell was still collecting, you know, in the 2000s.
Right. There are still Novell networks out being used.
And they're paying maintenance. I mean, they were then. I don't know about now, but they still were then. And it shocked me. I said, my goodness, like never would have imagined that.
It was a good business model for them. Created that cash cow to milk it.
Exactly.
Very good. And as you've talked through this, I know I've seen some slides from you in the past on addressing some of these topics. Is that a presentation I can include with the show notes for this interview? And I think it'd be a good resource for people to look at and have available.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can forward you the links.
That would be great. I'll include that with the show notes for this too.
Okay.
And as listeners know, when we get to the end of our time together, I always like to ask for a innovation quote and why people chose that quote or like it. There's lots of good ones that can be picked. Do you have an innovation quote that you enjoy that you want to share?
Yeah, I have a few, but you know, not to sound redundant, the one that I say a lot, you know, probably too often is sort of we've already talked about. It's nail it, then scale it.
Okay.
And really, I think it applies not just to product management, it applies to business in general, and I think it even applies to other aspects of life, which is simply that whatever you're doing, get it right on a small scale, right? Mm-hmm. Make sure you understand it, make sure you know what's right, what's wrong with it, etc., before you multiply all of that by going big, right? So, you know, if you have something that has a lot of problems and you scale, well, guess what? You're just multiplying the problems.
Exactly.
And so when I hear people say things like go big or go home, I look at them and say, you should just go home. because
love that response.
That analogy or that, you know, sort of those two things are not opposites. They're not things that are mutually exclusive. There's something else that needs to be thought through there. And I've seen it sadly in companies where there's either like an impatience to get the revenue or there's not a clear understanding of what's really involved. I was once in a startup where a board member basically said, you know, like we were doing research. We're doing like basic research on where to take the company. Mm-hmm. And the board member listening to what we're doing said, well, which one of these things do you really think is the most, you know, probable one? And I said, well, it's hard to say, but, you know, right now, based on what we know, it, you know, it'd be number three, let's say. And he goes, so why don't you just do that? And I kind of looked at him and I said, because we don't know if it's actually right.
Right.
Like we've just started our research and, you know, like this is the first board meeting where we're reporting back on our research. Like it just stunned me that here's someone who, you know, had a financial investment in the company. I'm trying to be wise about where we're going to spend their money. And he has this impatience where he's saying, just go with your gut. You know, like that's good enough for him.
Right. And it may have worked for him before, right? And they made the right choice and got lucky. And like when you talk about nailing it,
yes,
like you said, you might not know where to start with that, right? You might have a few customer markets you've identified and you do the experiments, right? And you see what sticks. And then once it sticks, then you can scale it.
Yeah. And in some cases, you know, like I always say this, decisions are always made with incomplete data, right? Calculations are made with complete data. Mm-hmm. And we never have complete data when we're in business. So we're always making decisions. There's always ambiguity involved, but you have to make those decisions. But let's make informed decisions and then let's move forward. And so you might say, yeah, we're not sure of those three. Yeah, maybe that third one was the right one, but let's get to a point where we can make an informed decision. And then maybe it is number three. But, you know, just to sort of say, hey, you know, at this very early stage, which one sounds good? I just find that that's where a lot of big problems occur, where CEOs or other leaders just, you know, you're like you said, maybe it worked for them before, but guess what? No guarantee at all it'll ever work for them again, you know?
I wish I could remember the name of this guy. He was a oil explorer, which probably has a much more technical term. But, you know, the guy that would go out and say where to drill.
Yeah.
And in reality, he was just lucky because it wasn't his space at all. He got associated with this company. Yes. I don't remember if you inherited it or bought it or what the deal was, right? But he recognized that the team just needed confidence. And he said, you know, we're going to get some of them wrong. We're going to get some of them right. But he just picked a place to drill and he got lucky the first time.
He got lucky.
And he got lucky the second time. And he got lucky enough in the early part that the company was successful, right?
Yes.
Until he could get real people in that knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Sometimes luck works. Well, I won't turn it down.
No, but it's only after the fact that you can claim that, right? You can't claim that before the fact. I mean, I don't know if you remember, there was a company called a search engine company that was run by or was founded by some ex-Google people, and it was C-I-U-L. It was pronounced cool, but it was, you know, the worst spelling. Anyway, yeah, I wouldn't expect you to have remembered it. I worked in the search engine space for a little while, so I used to track these things. But, they left Google. They wanted to create the next Google. They decided to, first of all, the name made no sense. Like, no one could spell it. But secondly, they came out with a search engine that was supposed to compete with Google that had very little sort of the web indexed and didn't give great search results. And what was funny was, like, you launched with big fanfare, you know, hey, these are ex-Googlers, and you set an expectation. You couldn't even deliver the most basic requirement that people have, like, give me some accurate search results.
Right.
Like, I don't know if Google has 1 billion, 10 billion, 100 billion web pages index. I really don't know, and I don't really care. I do know that when I search for stuff, it generally gives me good results.
Right. That's what you want.
Right. So, you know, nail it before you scale it. They were out of business in about 6 months. Like, literally, they came, they had this big launch, it was a failure, and 6 months later, or some very short period of time, I blogged about it way back then, it had disappeared. And, you know, like, I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars down the drain. And you'd be like, where were the VCs? Like, didn't anyone test this thing and go, hey, you know, I did some searches, and it's not really very good. Dude, should we really launch this yet? Mm-hmm. But that was a case of they scaled it before they nailed it. And that's why this thing, I mean, it sounds trite, but you see it all the time.
You do, right? It's such a big problem, people building products that we don't need, right? And it just don't work. So I love the quote. I'm going to add it to my list of things I share. And I'll try to give you attribution when I remember, but you know, I'm warning you, I might just steal it. So the nail it before you scale it, it's great.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your blog earlier too. How can people find out, just, you know, track the work that you're doing? And you're making lots of great contributions to the space of product management and sharing good knowledge. How can we find out more about that?
Sure, thanks. So the blog is called onproductmanagement.net. So onproductmanagement.net. Okay. So it should be easy to find. I have to be honest, I've been a little negligent in terms of updating the content, but we have about 8 or 9 years of content there from many, many contributors, not just me. You know, I welcome guest posts from people, you know, working in product management or innovation or product development. So if people are interested in contributing, absolutely, love to hear from you. But there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of articles there covering the topic we've discussed here today, metrics, as well as, you know, many other really good topics.
Excellent. And I will add that to the show notes too and make it easy to find on productmanagement.net.
Okay, great.
Very good. Well, I so much appreciate your time. We talked about metrics and other aspects of product management, and it was an enjoyable conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chad. This has been great.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening and for sharing this podcast with other product managers and innovators. If you're not already connected with me on LinkedIn, please send me a connection request. Just search for Chad McAllister, PhD, on LinkedIn, and you'll find me easily. For the summary of the discussion with Saeed and the full transcript, just go to theeverydayinnovator.com/087. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.